We had talked earlier about beginning work in physical organic chemistry. It's clear who you were being fed by on the West Coast, but who were your heroes otherwise? Who were you reading?
Frank Westheimer was an absolute hero, and I still think that he deserves a Nobel Prize. It's unlikely that he'll get one, but he was really a model of creativity. He had an instinct for the new, the cutting edge, and for doing new things, and for the decisive experiment. And I've admired him throughout his career. And we never worked in areas that overlapped with each other, but from the outside, I could see the quality of that work. It was really extraordinary.
He once said to me that he said, most people are granted perhaps one area where they've made a discovery in their lives.
Yeah.
And he actually had done at least three different areas.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. That was one of the things that attracted me to him, is that there was that creativity, that ability to get beyond just things that he had grown up with and worked on all his life. Mm-hmm. So I was very impressed with him. Other people, Hammett became more of a factor in my estimation as time went on, because I became closer to physical organic chemistry and I could appreciate what he had done. Early on, when I was in graduate school, I was so dumb I didn't realize how important this stuff was.
You just didn't see the changes that were taking place at that time.
I was out of it. I had not.
Like most of us when we were young, we were very focused.
Very focused, I could appreciate that there was something real and solid there, but the applicability of it, the broad scope of it, didn't hit me until considerably later. I'm thinking about people in other countries. Ingold, I read a lot of Ingold in those days. He and Weinstein were mortal enemies. Although I don't think it ever got to the stage that Brown Weinstein did. Mm-hmm. But I found his way of crediting the work of other people to be a little bit self-serving and less than generous, but I think that was a common complaint. But his science, I think, was by and large seminal. I think that the recognition of the importance of the kinetic examination of substitution reactions, nucleophilic and electrophilic substitution reactions, was tremendously important. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he got everything right there. I think that there were some things that about the stereochemistry of what were essentially neighboring group reactions that he refused to call that, because he could see that Weinstein had anticipated a lot of this stuff. So he went out of his way to devise a completely new set of nomenclature for that. I didn't find that very admirable. I thought it was kind of petty. But as a scientist, I think he was a considerable guy, and one cannot overlook the importance of what he did.
Interesting. It just occurred to me that, he sort of painted these mechanisms with very broad strokes, and wasn't worried about a lot of the detail. I mean, a lot of the work has been refined and refined many times. And it's
That's
probably
right.
a good thing that he didn't.
That's right.
I mean, because people would have gotten bogged down in the details. And
well, I think that's certainly true. And you can see that even in something, a paper as early as the sulvolysis reaction, the SN1 reaction, so-called, which really, if you look at it, doesn't have first-order kinetics. It's not a unimolecular reaction. It's a very complicated process. It involves reverse reactions, and he recognized that. He worked out all the kinetics for that. Then he found ways of shutting off the back reaction so that it did become just first order. So but that was all, I thought, very well done. But he pushed the nomenclature. He tried the categorizations, I think, offended a lot of people because it looked as though he was trying to subsume the whole field
for himself right.
and make everyone else sort of working on his problems.
Right.
And the field was much bigger than that, and I think that was a tactical mistake on his part.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much a scientific mistake, but a tactical mistake.
You did a fair amount of consulting work. You started consulting as early as 57. Did you think the consulting had some value for your own research? Did it play an important role for academicians in general? I mean, not just your consulting, but do you think it's important? Did it do anything in terms of the academic-industrial interface as far as you were concerned? Or was it just a way to make a living?
it was all of those things. I'd say, first of all, that I did learn something from these interactions. But I was always painfully aware of the fact that I wasn't being told everything there was to know.
Mm-hmm.
And this was frustrating. And ultimately, I got very tired of being left on the outside. And whenever I got too close to encroaching on a sensitive area, a proprietary area that they didn't want me to know about, you could just feel everybody clam up.
Yeah,
and so,
I think the consultants, they would sort of trust to that.
Only in certain areas. It's very, on a need-to-know basis, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They had very specific questions for the most part. How can I do this reaction, or how do I model these kinetics, or whatever? And so there was kind of a limited learning process there. I suppose that in some sense, my connection with industry, my being known as having connections with industry in the form of consultantships, smoothed the way for my students to get jobs in industry. Now, I'm trying to remember, I don't know of any specific cases in which a company came to me and said, do you have any of your students that you want to recommend, and then just followed my advice. It was always on the basis of a pretty open an interview process that anybody could participate in, and my recommendation carried whatever weight it carried, but it didn't go beyond that. I was not on the inside of their hiring practice. So it was not a, I don't think it was terribly important from that point of view. But I think it did help me in advising students about what industrial life was like. Because I had been an industrial chemist only at a very junior level for a short period of time. So that was valuable to me. And many of my students went into industry. I think I counted sometime not too different past not too distant past it, there were something like 20 former students from our lab working at DuPont at one time or another.
Really? you've gotten a lot of awards and honors and so on. Now, I'm not interested in those. I can read those off the list. What I wanted to know was, what did you think your real rewards were in the work? I mean, you put a lot of time into it.
Yeah, well, how can I put it? From the scientific point of view, most of the time I felt like a hack golfer. Have you ever played golf? It's a very humiliating game. It's a very humiliating game, and you can play an awful lot of holes before you hit one good shot. And so I felt that I spent years fumbling around, doing things that didn't work out or that worked out sort of in an uncontrolled way where I wasn't really able to get a lot of satisfaction about the way they came out. I mean, we published the results, but they weren't very influential, and they were ultimately forgettable. But a few times, things did work out, and those are just indescribable moments of joy, because you felt that you had made connections with the universe in some small way, that some little part of it you finally understood, and you had nailed it down, and it really did work that way. And so there are a few of those cases, maybe half a dozen that I can think of. That now the rest of it was a lot of it was had a teaching function, and students learned a lot from their problems. I learned an enormous amount from interacting with the students. Let's face it, the older I got, the tougher it was for me to keep up with the latest developments. These students were coming in. They were taking all these courses from my hotshot colleagues, and they would transmit that stuff to me, which was really about the only way I could possibly keep up. And a lot of problems we worked on together, students and I, and big battles of learning spin quantum mechanics, which was just an awful struggle for me, which I, you know, a lot of it I've forgotten now, but it was, I got to the point where I did understand it at one time. But this was in close collaboration with Dave Seeger and Ed Hilinsky, two very strong students of mine. Mm-hmm. And so none of that was in my background, you see. And this was one of the most exhilarating parts of being a professor and trying to continue to evolve and to move into new areas of research is that you are forced to learn something new. So you remain a student all your life. You have no choice. I mean, you can if you can stay in one area and continue to turn that crank and you pump out lots and lots of papers, but that isn't a lot of fun.
Right.
And so the other thing requires you just gotta suck up your gut and make the effort to learn something new. And I had to do that two or three times during my life. One was the thing we've been talking about a lot of this afternoon, is switching from natural products chemistry to physical organic. But then within my physical organic work, two or three times, all the bioradical stuff and all the thermal rearrangement stuff, I had to learn that from the ground up. I didn't know any of that to start with. It was not in my background. And one way or another, with the help of students and colleagues, I got into it enough so that we could do some work in those areas. And that learning process is very exciting. It's very exhilarating. You feel your powers expanding somehow. And so those are rewards. Those are out and out things that you can't get anyplace else but in academic work. You have the power. It's up to you. You have no boss. Nobody's telling you what to do. It's entirely up to you. And that independence, it's a very, very precious thing. And I'm just going to be eternally grateful for that as long as I live. That's just a tremendous privilege that is put at the disposal of people like us who have that freedom, yeah, that opportunity.
where do you see the future of organic chemistry? Actually, physical organic chemistry, does it exist any longer? I mean, has it been subsumed? The computer did certain things to change things drastically, but where's organic chemistry going? Where's physical organic chemistry, if there is such a thing anymore?
Well, I really shouldn't say much about organic chemistry because I've had run-ins with people who say dismissive and derogatory things about other people's work and dismiss whole fields as being sort of old-fashioned and irrelevant. And physical organic chemistry has gone through some cycles of that, by the way. So I won't. I have some thoughts on this. I'll make it more general without pinpointing any individuals. But I would say that one thing that I see about organic chemistry is the enormous role that is being exerted by the government granting agencies, who in turn are responding to enormous pressures from the pharmaceutical industry. If you look at the funding patterns in organic chemistry today, you will find tremendous amounts of money being spent with the stated ultimate objective of developing new drugs. Now, I'm not saying that's an unworthy objective, but I'm saying that to essentially convert the whole field of organic chemistry to that goal is excessive. And the way we're going about it is not going to work. I mean, it's not going to work that we're going to provide larger quantities of a rare antibiotic or carcinostatic material by total synthesis, 37 steps. That's not going to be a commercial process. So I think there's an overemphasis there, but we have to keep in mind that people will follow the money. And so I won't call it a switch, but certainly a diversion.
I think that this enormous overemphasis on synthesis is actually money-driven.
That's the driving force. That's my analysis of it, for what it's worth. And it has several aspects to it. It draws in lots of students because the pharmaceutical industry hires lots and lots of chemists. And when they hire chemists, they won't even look at physical organic chemists. They want people who are trained in synthesis. Not that this disregards the fact that what my work is 90% synthesis of some pretty hard molecules, but that doesn't cut any ice. They want people who are committed to that kind of lifestyle. And okay, that's fine. They need that, presumably, but that taken simultaneously with the drying up of the heavy chemical industry in the United States, which simultaneously means the drying up of opportunities in industry for physical organic chemists, means that nobody wants to do physical organic chemistry anymore. Young kids don't want to go in that direction, and who can blame them, after all? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You can't get a job. I mean, why should I do that? I mean, these are very interesting problems you're working on, Professor, but I can't get a job doing that. So that's the end of that. So the question of whether there is anything more to be done in physical organic chemistry is almost the moot point. There isn't anybody around to do it. So there's still people working on it. I mean, I went to the Mechanisms Conference last summer, and it was a beautiful conference. There was lots of very good work going on. A lot of it was in biological areas. So if you want to say, does physical organic chemistry still exist? I would say it exists, but to a considerable extent in its application to biological problems. What worries me about that is that because the field of research in physical organic chemistry is shrinking due to this decrease in funding patterns and the shift in the student interest. We're getting to the point where I worry that academic departments are not hiring professional physical organic chemists for their faculty anymore. And it seems to me that it's only a matter of time before we reach the point where this kind of rigor in the physical organic way of thinking is going to be a thing of the past. So we will have more and more approximate ways of dealing with problems, even biological problems, and that's going to be a net loss to the progress not only of physical organic chemistry but to also of biology ultimately. So that would be a plea that I would make, is we ought to try to save enough of physical organic chemistry as a separate freestanding discipline to nurture the growth and contributions of a cadre, at least a small cadre of people who are devoted to this subject and to its cultivation. We're not doing that, and I'm very worried about that. So I don't know what else to say about this kind of a selfish point of view about chemistry. I don't see a big role for the development of academic departments in the direction of utility. In other words, I don't think that making devices in chemistry departments is a direction we ought to go in. I think that gets to be quickly very applied, and the component of real chemistry, of new chemistry in there, begins to diminish. And if you get people started in that direction, they start to be funded with that objective in mind, and it's very difficult for them to explore the real academic underpinnings of what they're doing. And the driving force to produce more and more utilitarian results is kind of irresistible. So I think there's a danger there for chemistry departments to become too focused on applications, on devices, on materials, molecular materials. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a point up to which chemists can make a chemical contribution. But beyond that point, it gets to be problematical about whether that really is something that should be done in the chemistry department, or whether our function should remain closer to the traditional function of nurturing chemistry for its own sake, not because we want to insulate ourselves from that, but that this is the seed corn of all these other disciplines: molecular biology, chemical biology, material science. All these things feed out from us, so we have to have some central core that has to be continued. That has to continue. We can't just drop that and say we're going to hire faculty now to make devices, and we're not hiring anybody in physical organic chemistry. And that's the kind of thing that's happening already at Yale, which was sort of an active place in physical organic chemistry for a while. But there's nothing on the horizon to nurture that field here. So, of course, this is a little bit self-serving what I'm saying. It's not totally objective, but I really think there is something to what I'm saying. It's not something that can be just casually tossed aside.
I keep thinking that, well, perhaps it's just been subsumed into the whole area of synthesis, you know, and all these guys who are doing synthesis are really thinking in physical organic terms, but I don't think...
Dream on.
I think the eternal optimist.
It's not true. I mean, you just look at the way they do things.
And it seems like they jumped back a whole century. I mean, it's the guys with the best memory or the best computerized...
Yeah, it is. Database is very important here. There's another place where instrumentation has made an enormous impact, and what I see there is that it is now so easy for a chemist to determine the course of a reaction that the motivation for really investigating the mechanism of that and finding out why it went that way is very small if your long-range objective is to get to a particular target molecule. Everything points in the other direction. What you have to do is to change the conditions of that reaction so that this step is going to work, or else to devise a different step and find out whether that works, essentially by empirical trial and error. No synthetic chemist that I know of worries an awful lot about mechanism. They can't. It's out of the question.
I'm laughing because Ralph Hirschman, who had gone from Merck to the University of Pennsylvania, and then he did some collaborations with Amos Smith.
Yeah.
And he said, they're continually arguing. He says, because I'll find some reaction that doesn't go for some reason, and I want to go and look and see why it doesn't go.
Yeah.
And Amos just wants to try the next reagent.
Amos has the realistic point of view, because his constituency is the group of people who counts the number of total syntheses that you have actually finished, not the bright ideas you've had, but how many syntheses, how many molecules have you made that somebody thinks are important molecules. So there's no motivation to go back and look at a mechanism. And I can't blame these guys. That's the world they live in.
Two final questions, simple ones. Do you have any advice for young aspiring chemists or people who are considering a career in chemistry? I mean, that you've already told me.
I don't know. I don't know what to say. My personal feeling is that there are a lot of things to be known about how reactions take place. That's basically what physical organic chemistry is. I think it's a fascinating field. And as we were saying earlier this afternoon, molecules, particularly organic molecules, are very complicated systems. We have not begun to scratch the surface of their behavior, of the things that control how reactions take place. And so there's a big field there. And I think that it's unfortunate that there are so few people working in it. The people who are probably doing the most interesting work now are the chemical physicists. Zawail, if I could get him to concentrate on what he should be doing, I think has a big contribution to make. He has a powerful weapon in his hands, but so far he has not, in my opinion, I have greatest admiration for that work, and I would never say that he doesn't deserve the Nobel Prize for developing that stuff. But it's a long way. That stuff that he does is at this moment a long way from solving a lot of problems in organic chemistry. It might ultimately, but he has got to make the effort to dig in and find out what those problems are and why his technique does not speak to those problems. Well, it's the work on the femtosecond spectroscopy, in which he detects transient intermediates whose lifetimes are very short. But the trouble is that he is working that technique, which I think potentially might be made very applicable to physical organic chemistry, and which I was very enthusiastic about when he first got in touch with me about talking about how it might apply. It's pretty clear. I asked him the first thing.
The fellow who did win the Nobel
Prize. He won the Nobel Prize, yeah. And he should have. I don't argue that point. I mean, it's a very beautiful and important work. But the point is that it does not, has not yet spoken to a single problem in organic chemistry as it's carried out in the lab. And the reason is that the way he does the experiment, the way he generates these transient intermediates, puts him 45 or 50 kilocalories above the transition state for the reaction. And so it's a domain that is never explored in the laboratory. When you carry out the Diels-Alder reaction in the laboratory, you may have some of those molecules going through that have 2 kilocalories above the transition state, 5, you know, there is a Boltzmann distribution, you're not 50 kilocalories above. So the immediate question is, how are you going to relate what he is observing to the problems of organic chemistry itself? I don't see how to make that connection, and as far as I know, he has never made that connection. But there is an interface there at which I think something could conceivably be worked out. There are other people working in other areas. There's a very interesting work going on in Barney Ellison's lab and at Colorado, and it was going on in the late Bob Squire's lab before he died tragically a couple of years ago at Purdue in the direct examination, gas phase examination and spectroscopy of biradicals. Similar work being done by Peter Chen at the Etihad.